From, among others, General Sir Alan Brooke, who commanded the British Second Corps and later became Field Marshal Lord Alan Brooke, Chief of the Imperial General Staff, see Sir Arthur Bryant, The Turn of the Tide, based on Alan Brooke's diaries, about the magnificent way his army fought. For a few days in May, I followed Reichenau's Sixth Army through Belgium and saw for myself the tenacity with which the Belgians struggled against insuperable odds. Not once did they break under the unmerciful and unopposed bombing of the Luftwaffe or when the German armor tried to cut through them. This could not be said of certain other Allied troops in that campaign. The Belgians held out for 18 days and would have held out much longer had not they, like the BEF and the French Northern Armies, been caught in a trap which was not of their making. Miracle at Dunkirk. Ever since May 20th, when Guderian's tanks broke through to Abbeville on the sea, the British Admiralty, on the personal orders of Churchill, had been rounding up shipping for a possible evacuation of the BEF and other Allied forces from the Channel ports. Non-combatant personnel and other useless mouths began to be ferried across the narrow sea to England at once. By May 24th, as we have seen, the Belgian front to the north was near collapse, and to the south, the German armor, striking up the coast from Abbeville, after taking Boulogne and enveloping Calais, had reached the Ah Canal only 20 miles from Dunkirk. In between were caught the Belgian army, the 9 divisions of the BEF, and 10 divisions of the French First Army. Though the terrain on the southern end of the pocket was bad tank country, being crisscrossed with canals, ditches, and flooded areas, Guderian's and Reinhardt's panzer corps already had 5 bridgeheads across the main barrier, the Ah Canal, between Gravelines on the sea and Saint-Omer, and were poised for the knockout blow, which would hammer the Allied armies against the anvil of the advancing German 6th and 18th armies pushing down from the northeast, and utterly destroy them. Suddenly, on the evening of May 24th, came the peremptory order from the High Command, issued at the insistence of Hitler with the prompting of Rundstedt and Göring, but over the violent objections of Brauchitsch and Halder, that the tank forces should halt on the canal line and attempt no further advance. This furnished Lord Gort an unexpected and vital reprieve which he and the British Navy and Air Force made the most of, and which, as Rundstedt later perceived and said, led to one of the great turning points of the war. How did this inexplicable stop order, on the threshold of what seemed certain to be the greatest German victory of the campaign, come about? What were the reasons for it, and who was responsible? The questions have provoked one of the greatest arguments of the war, among the German generals involved, and among the historians. The generals, led by Rundstedt and Halder, have put the blame exclusively on Hitler. Churchill added further fuel to the controversy in the second volume of his war memoirs by contending that the initiative for the order came from Rundstedt and not Hitler, and citing as evidence the war diaries of Rundstedt's own headquarters. In the maze of conflicting and contradictory testimony, it has been difficult to ascertain the facts. In the course of preparing this chapter, the author wrote General Halder himself for further elucidation and promptly received a courteous and detailed reply. On the basis of this and much other evidence now in, certain conclusions may be drawn and the controversy settled, if not conclusively, at least fairly convincingly. As for responsibility for the famous order, Rundstedt, despite his later assertions to the contrary, must share it with Hitler. The Führer visited the General's Army Group A headquarters at Charleville on the morning of May 24th. Rundstedt proposed that the panzer divisions on the canal line before Dunkirk be halted until more infantry could be brought up. This fact, established from the records of Rundstedt's own headquarters, did not prevent the general from making several statements after the war which put the blame entirely on Hitler. "If I had had my way," he told Major Milton Schulman, a Canadian intelligence officer, "the English would not have got off so lightly at Dunkirk, but my hands were tied by direct orders from Hitler himself. While the English were clambering into the ships off the beaches, I was kept uselessly outside the port, unable to move. I sat outside the town, watching the English escape while my tanks and infantry were prohibited from moving. This incredible blunder was due to Hitler's personal idea of generalship." Schulman, Defeat in the West, pages 42 to 43. To a commission of the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg on June 20, 1946, mimeographed transcript, page 1490. Rundstedt added, "That was a very big mistake of the commander. How angry we leaders were at that time is indescribable." Rundstedt made similar declarations to Little Hart, The German General's Talk, pages 112 to 113, and to the Nuremberg Military Tribunal in the trial of United States versus Leib, pages 3350 to 3353 and 3931 to 3932 of the mimeographed transcript. Telford Taylor in The March of Conquest and Major L.F. Ellis in The War in France and Flanders, 1939 to 40, have analyzed the German army records of the incident and drawn conclusions that somewhat differ. Ellis's book is the official British account of the campaign and contains both British and German documents. Taylor, who spent 4 years as an American prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials, is an authority on the German documents. Hitler agreed with Rundstedt, observing that the armor should be conserved for later operations against the French south of the Somme. Moreover, he declared that if the pocket in which the Allies were entrapped became too small, it would hamper the activities of the Luftwaffe. Probably Rundstedt, with the approval of the Führer, issued the stop order at once, for Churchill notes that the BEF intercepted a German radio message giving orders to that effect at 11:42 that morning. Hitler and Rundstedt were at that moment in conference. At any rate, that evening Hitler issued the formal order from OKW, both Jodl and Halder noting it in their diaries. The general staff chief was most unhappy. "Our left wing, consisting of armor and motorized forces," he wrote in his diary, "will thus be stopped dead in its tracks on the direct orders of the Führer. Finishing off the encircled enemy army is to be left to the Air Force." This exclamation mark of contempt indicates that Goering had intervened with Hitler, and it is now known that he did. He offered to liquidate the entrapped enemy troops with his air force alone. The reasons for his ambitious and vain proposal were given the writer in a letter from Halder on July 19, 1957. During the following days, that is after May 24th, it became known that Hitler's decision was mainly influenced by Goering. To the dictator, the rapid movement of the army, whose risks and prospects of success he did not understand because of his lack of military schooling, became almost sinister. He was constantly oppressed by a feeling of anxiety that a reversal loomed. Goering, who knew his Führer well, took advantage of this anxiety. He offered to fight the rest of the great battle of encirclement alone with his Luftwaffe, thus eliminating the risk of having to use the valuable panzer formations. He made this proposal for a reason which was characteristic of the unscrupulously ambitious Goering. He wanted to secure for his air force, after the surprisingly smooth operations of the army up to then, the decisive final act in the great battle, and thus gain the glory of success before the whole world. General Halder then tells in his letter of an account given him by Brauchitsch after a talk which the latter had with the Luftwaffe generals Milch and Kesselring in Nuremberg jail in January 1946. In which the Air Force officers declared that Goering at that time, May 1940, emphasized to Hitler that if the great victory in battle then developing could be claimed exclusively by the army generals, the prestige of the Führer in the German homeland would be damaged beyond repair. That could be prevented only if the Luftwaffe and not the army carried out the decisive battle. It is fairly clear, then, that Hitler's idea, prompted by Goering and Rundstedt but strenuously opposed by Brauchitsch and Halder, was to let the Air Force and Box Army Group B, which, without any armor to speak of, was slowly driving back the Belgians and British southwest of the Channel, mop up the enemy troops in the pocket. Rundstedt's Army Group A, with some 7 tank divisions, halted on the water lines west and south of Dunkirk, would merely stand pat and keep the enemy hemmed in. But neither the Luftwaffe nor Bach's army group proved able to achieve their objectives. On the morning of May 26th, Halder was fuming in his diary that these orders from the top just make no sense. The tanks are stopped as if they were paralyzed. Finally, on the evening of May 26th, Hitler rescinded the stop order and agreed that, in view of Bach's slow advance in Belgium and the movement of transports off the coast, the armored forces could resume their advance on Dunkirk. By then it was late. The cornered enemy had had time to strengthen his defenses, and behind them was beginning to slip away to sea. We now know that there were political reasons, too, for Hitler's fatal order. Halder had noted in his diary on May 25th, the day, he says, that started off with one of those painful wrangles between Brauchitsch and the Führer on the next moves in the Battle of Encirclement, that now political command has formed the fixed idea that the Battle of Decision must not be fought on Flemish soil, but rather in northern France. This entry puzzled me, and when I wrote to the former General Staff Chief, I asked him if he could recall Hitler's political reasons for wanting to finish this battle in northern France rather than in Belgium. Halder recalled them very well. "According to my still quite lively memory," he replied, "Hitler, in our talks at the time, supported his reasons for the stop order with two main lines of thought. The first were military reasons, the unsuitable nature of the terrain for tanks, the resulting high losses, which would weaken the impending attack on the rest of France, and so on. Then," writes Halder, "the Führer cited a second reason, which he knew that we as soldiers could not argue against, since it was political and not military. This second reason was that for political reasons he did not want the decisive final battle, which inevitably would cause great damage to the population, to take place in territory inhabited by the Flemish people. He had the intention, he said, of making an independent National Socialist region out of the territory inhabited by the German-descended Flemish, thereby binding them close to Germany. His supporters on Flemish soil had been active in this direction for a long time. He had promised them to keep their land free from the damage of war. If he did not keep this promise now, their confidence in him would be severely damaged. That would be a political disadvantage for Germany, which he, as the politically responsible leader, must avoid." Absurd? If this seems to be another of Hitler's sudden aberrations, Halder writes that he and Brauchitsch were not convinced by this reasoning. Other political consideration, which he confided to other generals, were more sane and important. Describing after the war Hitler's meeting with Rundstedt on May 24th, General Günter Blumentritt, the latter's chief of operations, told Little Hart, the British military writer, "Hitler was in very good humor and gave us his opinion that the war would be finished in 6 weeks. After that, he wished to conclude a reasonable peace with France, and then the way would be free for an agreement with Britain. He then astonished us by speaking with admiration of the British Empire, of the necessity for its existence, and of the civilization that Britain had brought into the world. He said that all he wanted from Britain was that she should acknowledge Germany's position on the continent. The return of Germany's colonies would be desirable, but not essential. He concluded by saying that his aim was to make peace with Britain on a basis that she would regard as compatible with her honor to accept." Such thoughts Hitler was to express often during the next few weeks to his generals, to Ciano and Mussolini, and finally in public. Ciano was astonished a month later to find the Nazi dictator, then at the zenith of his success, harping about the importance of maintaining the British Empire as a factor in world equilibrium. And on July 13th, Halder, in his diary, described the Führer as sorely puzzled over Britain's failure to accept peace. "To bring England to her knees by force," he told his generals that day, "would not benefit Germany, only Japan, the United States, and others." It may be then, though some doubt it, that Hitler restrained his armored forces before Dunkirk in order to spare Britain a bitter humiliation and thereby facilitate a peace settlement. It would have to be, as he said, a peace in which the British left Germany free to turn once more eastward, this time against Russia. London would have to recognize, as he also said, the Third Reich's domination of the continent. For the next couple of months, Hitler would be confident that such a peace was within his grasp. No more now than in all the years before did he comprehend the character of the British nation or the kind of world its leaders and its people were determined to fight for. To the end. Nor did he and his generals, ignorant of the sea as they were, and remained, dream that the sea-minded British could evacuate 250,000 men from a small battered port and from the exposed beaches right under their noses. At 7:03 on the evening of May 26th, shortly after Hitler's stop order had been cancelled, the British Admiralty signaled the beginning of Operation Dynamo, as the Dunkirk evacuation was called. That night the German armor resumed its attack on the port from the west and south, but now the panzers found it hard going. Lord Gort had had time to deploy against them 3 infantry divisions with heavy artillery support. The tanks made little progress. In the meantime, the evacuation began. an armada of 850 vessels of all sizes, shapes, and methods of propulsion, from cruisers and destroyers to small sailboats and Dutch scouts, many of them manned by civilian volunteers from the English coastal towns, converged on Dunkirk. The first day, May 27th, they took off 7,669 troops. The next day, 17,804. The following day, 47,310. And on May 30th, 53,823, for a total of 126,606 during the first 4 days. This was far more than the Admiralty had hoped to get out. When the operation began, it counted on evacuating only about 45,000 men in the 2 days' time it then thought it would have. It was not until this fourth day of Operation Dynamo, on May 30th, that the German High Command woke up to what was happening. For 4 days, the communiques of OKW had been reiterating that the encircled enemy armies were doomed. A communique of May 29th, which I noted in my diary, stated flatly, "The fate of the French army in Artois is sealed. The British army, which has been compressed into the territory around Dunkirk, is also going to its destruction before our concentric attack." But it wasn't. It was going to sea. Without its heavy arms and equipment, to be sure, but with the certainty that the men would live to fight another day. As late as the morning of May 30th, Halder confided confidentially in his diary that "the disintegration of the enemy which we have encircled continues." Some of the British, he conceded, were fighting with tooth and nail. The others were fleeing to the coast and trying to get across the channel on anything that floats. Le débâcle, he concluded, alluding to Zola's famous novel of the French collapse in the Franco-Prussian War. By afternoon, after a session with Brauchitsch, the general staff chief had awakened to the significance of the swarms of miserable little boats on which the British were fleeing. "Brauchitsch is angry. The pocket would have been closed to the coast if only our armor had not been held back. The bad weather has grounded the Luftwaffe, and we must now stand by and watch countless thousands of the enemy get away to England right under our noses." That was, in fact, what they watched. Despite increased pressure, which was immediately applied by the Germans on all sides of the pocket, the British lines held, and more troops were evacuated. The next day, May 31st, was the biggest day of all. Some 68,000 men were embarked for England, a third of them from the beaches, the rest from the Dunkirk harbor. A total of 194,620 men had now been taken out, more than four times the number originally hoped for. Where was the famed Luftwaffe? Part of the time, as Halder noted, it was grounded by bad weather. The rest of the time it encountered unexpected opposition from the Royal Air Force, which from bases just across the channel successfully challenged it for the first time. A good many of the exhausted Tommies on the beaches, who underwent severe bombings, were not aware of this, since the air clashes were often above the clouds or some distance away. They knew only that they had been bombed and strafed all the way back from eastern Belgium to Dunkirk, and they felt their air force had let them down. When they reached the home ports, some of them insulted men in the blue RAF uniforms. Churchill was much aggrieved at this and went out of his way to put them right when he spoke in the House on June 4th. The deliverance at Dunkirk, he said, was gained by the Air Force. Though outnumbered, the new British Spitfires proved more than a match for the Messerschmitts, and they mowed down the cumbersome German bombers. On a few occasions, Goering's planes arrived over Dunkirk between British sorties and did such extensive damage to the port that for a time it was unusable and the troops had to be lifted exclusively from the beaches. The Luftwaffe also pressed several strong attacks on the shipping and accounted for most of the 243 out of 861 vessels sunk. But it failed to achieve what Goering had promised Hitler, the annihilation of the BEF. On June 1st, when it carried out its heaviest attack and suffered its heaviest losses, each side lost 30 planes, sinking three British destroyers and a number of small transports, the second highest day's total was evacuated, 64,429 men. By dawn of the next day, only 4,000 British troops remained in the perimeter, protected by 100,000 French who now manned the defenses. Medium German artillery had in the meantime come within range, and daytime evacuation operations had to be abandoned. The Luftwaffe at that time did not operate after dark, and during the nights of June 2nd and 3rd, the remainder of the BEF and 60,000 French troops were successfully brought out. Dunkirk, still defended stubbornly by 40,000 French soldiers, held out until the morning of June 4th. By that day, 338,226 British and French soldiers had escaped the German clutches. They were no longer an army. Most of them, understandably, were for the moment in a pitiful shape. But they were battle-tried. They knew that if properly armed and adequately covered from the air, they could stand up to the Germans. Most of them, when the balance in armament was achieved, would prove it, and on beaches not far down the Channel coast from where they had been rescued. A deliverance Dunkirk was to the British, but Churchill reminded them in the House on June 4th that wars are not won by evacuations. The predicament of Great Britain was indeed grim, more dangerous than it had been since the Norman landings nearly a millennium before. It had no army to defend the islands. The air force had been greatly weakened in France. Only the navy remained, and the Norwegian campaign had shown how vulnerable the big fighting ships were to land-based aircraft. Now the Luftwaffe bombers were based but 5 or 10 minutes away across the narrow channel. France, to be sure, still held out below the Somme and the Aisne. But its best troops and armament had been lost in Belgium and in northern France. Its small and obsolescent air force had been largely destroyed, and its two most illustrious generals, Marshal Pétain and General Weygand, who now began to dominate the shaky government, had no more stomach for battle against such a superior foe. These dismal facts were very much on the mind of Winston Churchill when he rose in the House of Commons on June 4, 1940, while the last transports from Dunkirk were being unloaded, determined, as he wrote later, to show not only his own people but the world, and especially the USA, that our resolve to fight on was based on serious grounds. It was on this occasion that he uttered his famous peroration, which will be long remembered and will surely rank with the greatest ever made down the ages. Even though large tracts of Europe and many old and famous states have fallen or may fall into the grip of the Gestapo and all the odious apparatus of Nazi rule, we shall not flag or fail. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight in the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And even if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle, until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old. The collapse of France. The determination of the British to fight on does not seem to have troubled Hitler's thoughts. He was sure they would see the light after he had finished off France, which he now proceeded to do. The morning after Dunkirk fell on June 5th, the Germans launched a massive assault on the Somme, and soon they were attacking in overwhelming strength all along a 400-mile front that stretched across France from Abbeville to the Upper Rhine. The French were doomed. Against 143 German divisions, including 10 armored, they could deploy only 65 divisions, most of them second-rate, for the best units and most of the armor had been expended in Belgium. Little was left of the weak French air force. The British could contribute but one infantry division, which had been in the Saar, and parts of an armored division. The RAF could spare few planes for this battle unless it were to leave the British Isles themselves defenseless. Finally, the French High Command, now dominated by Pétain and Weygand, had become sodden with defeatism. Nevertheless, some French units fought with great bravery and tenacity, temporarily stopping even the German armor here and there, and standing up resolutely to the incessant pounding of the Luftwaffe. But it was an unequal struggle. In victorious confusion, as Telford Taylor has aptly put it, the German troops surged across France like a tidal wave, the confusion coming because there were so many of them and they were moving so fast and often getting in each other's way. On June 10th, the French government hastily departed Paris, and on June 14th, the great city, the glory of France, which was undefended, was occupied by General von Kukler's 18th Army. The swastika was immediately hoisted on the Eiffel Tower. On June 16th, Premier Reynaud, whose government had fled to Bordeaux, resigned and was replaced by Pétain, who the next day asked the Germans through the Spanish ambassador for an armistice. On this day, June 17, 1940, the exiled Kaiser sent from Doorn in occupied Holland a telegram of congratulations to Hitler, whom he had for so long scorned as a vulgar upstart. It was found among the captured Nazi papers. Under the deeply moving impression of the capitulation of France, I congratulate you and the whole German Wehrmacht on the mighty victory granted by God. In the words of the Emperor Wilhelm the Great in 1870, what a turn of events brought about by divine dispensation. In all German hearts there echoes the Leuthen chorale sung by the victors of Leuthen, the soldiers of the great king. Now thank we all our God. Hitler, who believed that the mighty victory was due more to himself than to God, drafted a restrained reply, but whether it was ever sent is not indicated in the documents. The Führer had been furious a little earlier when he learned that a German unit which overran Doorn had posted a guard of honor around the exiled emperor's residence. Hitler ordered the guard removed and Doorn posted as out of bounds to all German soldiers. Wilhelm II died at Doorn on June 4, 1941, and was buried there. His death, Hassel noted in his diary, page 200, went almost unnoticed in Germany. Hitler and Goebbels saw to that. Hitler replied to Pétain the same day that he would first have to consult with his ally Mussolini. For this strutting warrior, after making sure that the French armies were hopelessly beaten, had, like a jackal, hopped into the war on June 10th to try to get in on the spoils. The Duce plunges his small dagger into France's back. Despite his preoccupation with the unfolding of the Battle of the West, Hitler had found time to write Mussolini at surprisingly frequent intervals, keeping him informed of the mounting German victories. After the first letter on May 7th, apprising the Duce that he was attacking Belgium and Holland to ensure their neutrality, and saying he would keep his friend informed of his progress so that the Duce could make his own decisions in time, there were further ones on May 13th, 18th, and 25th, each more detailed and enthusiastic than the other. Though the generals, as Halder's diary confirms, couldn't have cared less what Italy did, whether it came into the war or not, the Führer for some reason attached importance to Italian intervention. As soon as the Netherlands and Belgium had surrendered and the Anglo-French northern armies had been smashed, and the surviving British troops began taking to the boats at Dunkirk, Mussolini decided to slither into the war. He informed Hitler by letter on May 30th that the date would be June 5th. Hitler replied immediately that he was most profoundly moved. If there could still be anything which could strengthen my unshakable belief in the victorious outcome of this war, Hitler wrote on May 31st, it was your statement. The mere fact of your entering the war is an element calculated to deal the front of our enemies a staggering blow. The Führer asked his ally, however, to postpone his date for 3 days. He wanted to knock out the rest of the French Air Force first, he said, and Mussolini obliged by setting it back 5 days, to June 10th. Hostilities, the Duce said, would begin the following day. They did not amount to much. By June 18th, when Hitler summoned his junior partner to Munich to discuss an armistice with France, some 32 Italian divisions, after a week of fighting, had been unable to budge a scanty French force of 6 divisions on the Alpine front and farther south along the Riviera, though the defenders were now threatened by assault in the rear from the Germans sweeping down the Rhone Valley. The defeatist French High Command forbade any offensive action against Italy. On June 14th, a French naval squadron bombarded factories, oil tanks, and refineries near Genoa, but Admiral Darlan prohibited any further action of this kind. When the RAF tried to send bombers from the airfield at Marseille to attack Milan and Turin, the French drove trucks onto the field and prevented the planes from taking off. On June 21st, Ciano noted in his diary, Mussolini is quite humiliated because our troops have not moved a step forward. Even today they have not succeeded in advancing and have halted in front of the first French fortification which put up some resistance. The hollowness of Mussolini's boasted military might was exposed at the very beginning, and this put the deflated Italian dictator in a dour mood as he and Ciano set out by train on the evening of June 17th to confer with Hitler about the armistice with France. Mussolini dissatisfied, Ciano wrote in his diary. This sudden peace disquiets him. During the trip, we speak at length in order to clarify conditions under which the armistice is to be granted to the French. The Duce would like to go so far as the total occupation of French territory and demands the surrender of the French fleet, but he is aware that his opinion has only a consultative value. The war has been won by Hitler without any active military participation on the part of Italy, and it is Hitler who will have the last word. This naturally disturbs and saddens Mussolini. The mildness of the Führer's last word came as a distinct shock to the Italians when they conferred with the Nazi warlord at the Führerhaus at Munich, where Chamberlain and Daladier had been so accommodating to the two dictators regarding Czechoslovakia less than 2 years before. The secret German memorandum of the meeting makes clear that Hitler was determined above all not to allow the French fleet to fall into the hands of the British. He was also concerned lest the French government flee to North Africa or to London and continue the war. For that reason, the armistice terms, the final terms of peace might be something else, would have to be moderate, designed to keep a French government functioning on French soil and the French fleet neutralized. He abruptly dismissed Mussolini's demands for the Italian occupation of the Rhone Valley, including Toulon, the great French Mediterranean naval base where most of the fleet was concentrated, and Marseille, and the disarmament of Corsica, Tunisia, and Djibouti. The last town, the gateway to Italian-held Ethiopia, was thrown in by Ciano, the German notes say, in an undertone. Even the bellicose Ribbentrop, Ciano found, was exceptionally moderate and calm, and in favor of peace. The warrior Mussolini was very much embarrassed, his son-in-law noted. He feels that his role is secondary. In truth, the Duce fears that the hour of peace is growing near, and sees fading once again that unattainable dream of his life, glory on the field of battle. Mussolini was unable even to get Hitler to agree to joint armistice negotiations with the French. The Führer was not going to share his triumph at a very historic spot, he declined to name it to his friend, with this Johnny-come-lately. But he promised the Duce that his armistice with France would not come into effect until the French had also signed one with Italy. Mussolini left Munich bitter and frustrated, but Ciano had been very favorably impressed by a side of Hitler which his diaries make clear he had not previously seen or suspected. From all that he, Hitler, says, he wrote in his diary as they returned to Rome, it is clear that he wants to act quickly to end it all. Hitler is now the gambler who has made a big scoop and would like to get up from the table, risking nothing more. Today he speaks with a reserve and a perspicacity which, after such a victory, are really astonishing. I cannot be accused of excessive tenderness toward him, but today I truly admire him. The Second Armistice at Compiègne. I followed the German army into Paris that June, always the loveliest of months in the majestic capital, which was now stricken, and on June 19th got wind of where Hitler was going to lay down his terms for the armistice which Pétain had requested 2 days before. It was to be on the same spot where the German Empire had capitulated to France and her allies on November 11th, 1918, in the little clearing in the woods at Compiègne. There the Nazi warlord would get his revenge, and the place itself would add to the sweetness of it for him. On May 20th, a bare 10 days after the great offensive in the West had started, and on the day the German tanks reached Abbeville, the idea had come to him. Jodl noted it in his diary that day. Führer is working on the peace treaty, first negotiations in the forest of Compiègne. Late on the afternoon of June 19th, I drove out there and found German army engineers demolishing the wall of the museum where the old wagon-lit of Marshal Foch, in which the 1918 armistice was signed, had been preserved. By the time I left, the engineers, working with pneumatic drills, had torn the wall down and were pulling the car out to the tracks in the center of the clearing on the exact spot, they said, where it had stood at 5 a.m. on November 11, 1918, when at the dictation of Foch, the German emissaries put their signatures to the armistice. And so it was that on the afternoon of June 21st I stood by the edge of the forest at Compiègne to observe the latest and greatest of Hitler's triumphs, of which, in the course of my work, I had seen so many over the last turbulent years. It was one of the loveliest summer days I ever remember in France. A warm June sun beat down on the stately trees, elms, oaks, cypresses, and pines, casting pleasant shadows on the wooded avenues leading to the little circular clearing. At 3:15 p.m. precisely, Hitler arrived in his big Mercedes, accompanied by Goering, Brauchitsch, Keitel, Raeder, Ribbentrop, and Hess, all in their various uniforms, and Goering, the lone field marshal of the Reich, fiddling with his field marshal's baton. They alighted from their automobiles some 200 yards away in front of the Alsace-Lorraine statue, which was draped with German war flags, so that the Führer could not see, though I remembered from previous visits in happier days, the large sword, the sword of the victorious Allies of 1918, sticking through a limp eagle representing the German Empire of the Hohenzollerns. Hitler glanced at the monument and strode on. I observed his face, I wrote in my diary. It was grave, solemn, yet brimming with revenge. There was also in it, as in his springy step, a note of the triumphant conqueror, the defier of the world. There was something else, a sort of scornful inner joy at being present at this great reversal of fate, a reversal he himself had wrought. When he reached the little opening in the forest, and his personal standard had been run up in the center of it, his attention was attracted by a great granite block which stood some 3 feet above the ground. Hitler, followed by the others, walks slowly over to it, I am quoting my diary, steps up and reads the inscription engraved, in French, in great high letters. Here on the 11th of November 1918 succumbed the criminal pride of the German Empire, vanquished by the free peoples which it tried to enslave. Hitler reads it, and Goering reads it. They all read it, standing there in the June sun and the silence. I look for the expression in Hitler's face. I am but 50 yards from him, and see him through my glasses as though he were directly in front of me. I have seen that face many times at the great moments of his life, but today it is afire with scorn, anger, hate, revenge, triumph. He steps off the monument and contrives to make even this gesture a masterpiece of contempt. He glances back at it, contemptuous, angry, angry, you almost feel, because he cannot wipe out the awful, provoking lettering with one sweep of his high Prussian boot. It was blown up 3 days later at Hitler's command. He glances slowly around the clearing, and now, as his eyes meet ours, you grasp the depth of his hatred. But there is triumph there, too. Revengeful, triumphant hate. Suddenly, as though his face were not giving quite complete expression to his feelings, he throws his whole body into harmony with his mood. He swiftly snaps his hands on his hips, arches his shoulders, plants his feet wide apart. It is a magnificent gesture of defiance, of burning contempt for this place now and all that it has stood for in the 22 years since it witnessed the humbling of the German Empire. Hitler and his party then entered the armistice railway car, the Führer seating himself in the chair occupied by Foch in 1918. 5 minutes later, the French delegation arrived, headed by General Charles Unziger, commander of the Second Army at Sedan, and made up of an admiral, an Air Force general, and one civilian, Léon Noël, the former ambassador to Poland, who was now witnessing his second debacle wrought by German arms. They looked shattered, but retained a tragic dignity. They had not been told that they would be led to this proud French shrine to undergo such a humiliation, and the shock was no doubt just what Hitler had calculated. As Halder wrote in his diary that evening after being given an eyewitness account by Brauchitsch, the French had no warning that they would be handed the terms at the very sight of the negotiations in 1918. They were apparently shaken by this arrangement and at first inclined to be sullen. Perhaps it was natural, even for a German so cultivated as Halder or Brauchitsch, to mistake solemn dignity for sullenness. The French, one saw at once, were certainly dazed. Yet, contrary to the reports at the time, they tried, as we now know from the official German minutes of the meetings found among the captured Nazi secret papers, to soften the harsher portions of the Führer's terms and to eliminate those which they thought were dishonorable. But they tried in vain. Hitler and his entourage left the wagon-lit as soon as General Keitel had read the preamble of the armistice terms to the French, leaving the negotiations in the hands of his OKW chief, but allowing him no leeway in departing from the conditions which he himself had laid down. Unziger told the Germans at once, as soon as he had read them, that they were hard and merciless, much worse than those which France had handed Germany here in 1918. Moreover, if another country beyond the Alps, which had not defeated France, Unziger was too contemptuous of Italy even to name her, advanced similar demands, France would in no circumstances submit. She would fight to the bitter end. It was therefore impossible for him to put his signature to the German armistice agreement. General Jodl, the number two officer at OKW, who presided temporarily at this moment, had not expected such defiant words from a hopelessly beaten foe, and replied that though he could not help express his understanding for what Unziger had said about the Italians, nevertheless he had no power to change the Führer's terms. All he could do, he said, was to give explanations and clear up obscure points. The French would have to take the armistice document or leave it as it was. The Germans had been annoyed that the French delegation had arrived without authority to conclude an armistice except with the express agreement of the government at Bordeaux. By a miracle of engineering, and perhaps with some luck, they succeeded in setting up a telephone connection from the old sleeping car right through the battle lines, where the fighting still continued, to Bordeaux. The French delegates were authorized to use it to transmit the text of the armistice terms and to discuss it with their government. Dr. Schmidt, who served as interpreter, was directed to listen in on the tapped conversations from an army communications van a few yards away behind a clump of trees. The next day, I myself contrived to hear the German recording of part of the conversation between Unziger and General Weygand. To the credit of the latter, who bears a grave responsibility for French defeatism and the final surrender and the break with Britain, it must be recorded that he at least strenuously objected to many of the German demands. One of the most odious of them obligated the French to turn over to the Reich all anti-Nazi German refugees in France and in her territories. Weygand called this dishonorable, in view of the French tradition of the right of asylum, but when it was discussed the next day, the arrogant Keitel would not listen to its being deleted. "The German émigrés," he shouted, "were the greatest warmongers. They had betrayed their own people. They must be handed over at all costs." The French made no protest against a clause which stated that all their nationals caught fighting with another country against Germany would be treated as francs-tireurs, that is, immediately shot. This was aimed against de Gaulle, who was already trying to organize a free French force in Britain, and both Weygand and Keitel knew it was a crude violation of the primitive rules of war. Nor did the French question a paragraph which provided for all prisoners of war to remain in captivity until the conclusion of peace. Weygand was sure the British would be conquered within 3 weeks, and the French POWs thereafter released. Thus he condemned 1.5 million Frenchmen to war prison camps for 5 years. The crux of the armistice treaty was the disposal of the French navy. Churchill, as France tottered, had offered to release her from her pledge not to make a separate peace if the French navy were directed to sail for British ports. Hitler was determined that this should not take place. He fully realized, as he told Mussolini on June 18th, that it would immeasurably strengthen Britain. With so much at stake, he had to make a concession, or at least a promise, to the beaten foe. The armistice agreement stipulated that the French fleet would be demobilized and disarmed, and the ships laid up in their home ports. In return for this, the German government solemnly declares to the French government that it does not intend to use for its own purposes in the war the French fleet which is in ports under German supervision. Furthermore, they solemnly and expressly declare that they have no intention of raising any claim to the French war fleet at the time of the conclusion of peace. Like almost all of Hitler's promises, this one too would be broken. Finally, Hitler left the French government an unoccupied zone in the south and southeast in which it ostensibly was free to govern. This was an astute move. It would not only divide France itself geographically and administratively, it would make difficult, if not impossible, the formation of a French government in exile, and quash any plans of the politicians in Bordeaux to move the seat of government to French North Africa, a design which almost succeeded, being defeated in the end not by the Germans but by the French defeatists, Pétain, Weygand, Laval, and their supporters. Moreover, Hitler knew that the men who had now seized control of the French government at Bordeaux were enemies of French democracy and might be expected to be cooperative in helping him set up the Nazi New Order in Europe. Yet on the second day of the armistice negotiations at Compiègne, the French delegates continued to bicker and delay. One reason for the delay was that Unziger insisted that Weygand give him not an authorization to sign, but an order. No one in France wanted to take the responsibility. Finally, at 6:30 p.m., Keitel issued an ultimatum. The French must accept or reject the German armistice terms within an hour. Within the hour, the French government capitulated. At 6:50 p.m. on June 22, 1940, Unziger and Keitel signed the armistice treaty. It was stipulated that it would go into effect as soon as the Franco-Italian armistice was signed, and that hostilities would cease 6 hours after that event. I listened to the last scene as it was picked up by the hidden microphones in the wagon lit. Just before he signed, the French general, his voice quivering, said he wished to make a personal statement. I took it down in French as he spoke. I declare that the French government has ordered me to sign these terms of armistice. Forced by the fate of arms to cease the struggle in which we were engaged on the side of the Allies, France sees imposed on her very hard conditions. France has the right to expect in the future negotiations that Germany show a spirit which will permit the two great neighboring countries to live and work in peace. Those negotiations, for a peace treaty, would never take place, but the spirit which the Nazi Third Reich would have shown, if they had, soon became evident as the occupation became harsher and the pressure on the servile Pétain regime increased. France was now destined to become a German vassal, as Pétain, Weygand, and Laval apparently believed, and accepted. A light rain began to fall as the delegates left the armistice car and drove away. Down the road through the woods you could see an unbroken line of refugees making their way home on weary feet, on bicycles, on carts, a few fortunate ones on old trucks. I walked out to the clearing. A gang of German army engineers, shouting lustily, had already started to move the old wagon lit. "Where to?" I asked. "To Berlin," they said. It arrived there July 8th. Ironically, it was destroyed in an Allied bombing of Berlin later in the war. The Franco-Italian armistice was signed in Rome 2 days later. Mussolini was able to occupy only what his troops had conquered, which meant a few hundred yards of French territory, and to impose a 50-mile demilitarized zone opposite him in France and Tunisia. The armistice was signed at 7:35 p.m. on June 24th. 6 hours later, the guns in France lapsed into silence. France, which had held out unbeaten for 4 years the last time, was out of the war after 6 weeks. German troops stood guard over most of Europe, from the North Cape above the Arctic Circle to Bordeaux, from the English Channel to the River Bug in eastern Poland. Adolf Hitler had reached the pinnacle. The former Austrian waif, who had been the first to unite the Germans in a truly national state, this corporal of the First World War, had now become the greatest of German conquerors. All that stood between him and the establishment of German hegemony in Europe under his dictatorship was one indomitable Englishman, Winston Churchill, and the determined people Churchill led, who did not recognize defeat when it stared them in the face, and who now stood alone, virtually unarmed, their island home besieged by the mightiest military machine the world had ever seen. Hitler plays for peace. 10 days after the German onslaught on the west began, on the evening German tanks reached Abbeville, General Jodl, after describing in his diary how the Führer was beside himself with joy, added, "Is working on the peace treaty. Britain can get a separate peace any time after restitution of the colonies." That was May 20th. For several weeks thereafter, Hitler seems to have had no doubts that, with France knocked out, Britain would be anxious to make peace. His terms, from the German point of view, seemed most generous, considering the beating the British had taken in Norway and in France. He had expounded them to General von Rundstedt on May 24th, expressing his admiration of the British Empire and stressing the necessity for its existence. All he wanted from London, he said, was a free hand on the continent. So certain was he that the British would agree to this that even after the fall of France he made no plans for continuing the war against Britain. And the vaunted General Staff, which supposedly planned with Prussian thoroughness for every contingency, far in advance, did not bother to furnish him any. Halder, the chief of the General Staff, made no mention of the subject at this time in his voluminous diary entries. He was more disturbed about Russian threats in the Balkans and the Baltic than about the British. Indeed, why should Great Britain fight on alone against helpless odds, especially when it could get a peace that would leave it, unlike France, Poland, and all the other defeated lands, unscathed, intact, and free? This was a question asked everywhere, except in Downing Street, where, as Churchill later revealed, it was never even discussed, because the answer was taken for granted. But the German dictator did not know this, and when Churchill began to state it publicly that Britain was not quitting, Hitler apparently did not believe it. Not even when on June 4th, after the evacuation from Dunkirk, the Prime Minister had made his resounding speech about fighting on in the hills and on the beaches. Not even when on June 18th, after Pétain had asked for an armistice, Churchill reiterated in the Commons Britain's inflexible resolve to continue the war, and in another one of his eloquent and memorable perorations concluded, "Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duties, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will say this was their finest hour." These could be merely soaring words from a gifted orator, and so Hitler, a dazzling orator himself, must have thought. He must have been encouraged, too, by soundings in neutral capitals and by the appeals for ending the war that now emanated from them. On June 28th, a confidential message arrived for Hitler from the Pope. Analogous communications were addressed to Mussolini and Churchill, offering his mediation for a just and honorable peace, and declaring that before initiating this step he wished to ascertain confidentially how it would be received. The King of Sweden was also active in proposing peace to both London and Berlin. In the United States, the German embassy, under the direction of Hans Thompson, the chargé d'affaires, was spending every dollar it could lay its hands on to support the isolationists in keeping America out of the war and thus discourage Britain from continuing it. The captured Foreign Office documents are full of messages from Thompson reporting on the embassy's efforts to sway American public opinion in Hitler's favor. The party conventions were being held that summer, and Thompson was bending every effort to influence their foreign policy planks, especially that of the Republicans. On June 12th, for example, he cabled Berlin in code, "Most urgent, top secret, that a well-known Republican congressman, who was working closely with the German embassy, had offered for $3,000 to invite 50 isolationist Republican congressmen to the Republican convention so that they may work on the delegates in favor of an isolationist foreign policy." The same individual, Thompson reported, wanted $30,000 to help pay for full-page advertisements in the American newspapers to be headed "Keep America Out of the War." Such an advertisement appeared in the New York Times, June 25, 1940. The next day, Thompson was wiring Berlin about a new project he said he was negotiating through an American literary agent to have 5 well-known American writers write books, from which I await great results. For this project he needed $20,000, a sum Ribbentrop okayed a few days later. By July 5, 1940, Thompson had become so apprehensive about his payments that he cabled Berlin for permission to destroy all receipts and accounts. "The payments are made to the recipients through trusted go-betweens, but in the circumstances, it is obvious that no receipts can be expected. Such receipts or memoranda would fall into the hands of the American Secret Service if the embassy were suddenly to be seized by American authorities, and despite all camouflage, by the fact of their existence alone, they would mean political ruin and have other grave consequences for our political friends, who are probably known to our enemies. I therefore request that the embassy be authorized to destroy these receipts and statements, and henceforth dispense with making them, as also with keeping accounts of such payments." This telegraphic report has been destroyed. One of Hitler's first public utterances about his hopes for peace with Britain had been given Karl von Wiegand, a Hearst correspondent, and published in the New York Journal-American on June 14th. A fortnight later, Thompson informed the German Foreign Office that he had printed 100,000 extra copies of the interview, and that, I was able, furthermore, through a confidential agent, to induce the isolationist representative Thorkelson, Republican of Montana, to have the Fuhrer interview inserted in the congressional record of June 22nd. This assures the interview once more the widest distribution. The Nazi embassy in Washington grasped at every straw. At one point during the summer, its press attaché was forwarding what he said was a suggestion of Fulton Lewis Jr., the radio commentator, whom he described as an admirer of Germany and the Fuhrer and a highly respected American journalist. The Fuhrer should address telegrams to Roosevelt, reading approximately as follows. You, Mr. Roosevelt, have repeatedly appealed to me and always expressed the wish that a sanguinary war be avoided. I did not declare war on England. On the contrary, I always stressed that I did not wish to destroy the British Empire. My repeated requests to Churchill to be reasonable and to arrive at an honorable peace treaty were stubbornly rejected by Churchill. I am aware that England will suffer severely when I order total war to be launched against the British Isles. I ask you, therefore, to approach Churchill on your part and prevail upon him to abandon his senseless obstinacy. Lewis added that Roosevelt would, of course, make a rude and spiteful reply. That would make no difference. Such an appeal would surely make a profound impression on the North American people, and especially in South America. Adolf Hitler did not take Mr. Lewis's purported advice, but the Foreign Office in Berlin cabled to ask how important the radio commentator was in America. Thompson replied that Lewis had enjoyed a particular success of late, but that, on the other hand, in contrast to some leading American commentators, no political importance is to be attached to L. The doings of the German embassy in Washington at this period, as disclosed in its own dispatches, which are published in Documents on German Foreign Policy, would furnish the material for a revealing book. One is struck by the tendency of the German diplomats to tell the Nazi dictator pretty much what he wanted to hear, a practice common among representatives of totalitarian lands. Two officers of OKW told me in Berlin that the high command, or at least the general staff, was highly suspicious of the objectivity of the reports from the Washington embassy, and that they had established their own military intelligence in the United States. They were not served very well by General Friedrich von Boedeker, the German military attaché in Washington, if one can judge by his dispatches included in the DGFP volumes. He never tired of warning OKW and the general staffs of the Army and Air Force to whom his messages were addressed that America was controlled by the Jews and the Freemasons, which was exactly what Hitler thought. Boedeker also overestimated the influence of the isolationists in American politics, especially of Colonel Charles A. Lindbergh, who emerges in his dispatches as his great hero. An extract or two indicates the tenor of his reports. July 20, 1940. As the exponents of the Jews, who especially through Freemasonry control the broad masses of the American people, Roosevelt wants England to continue fighting and the war to be prolonged. The circle about Lindbergh has become aware of this development and now tries at least to impede the fatal control of American policy by the Jews. I have repeatedly reported on the mean and vicious campaign against Lindbergh, whom the Jews fear as their most potent adversary. DGFP, Volume 10, pages 254-255. August 6, 1940. The background of Lindbergh's reemergence in public and the campaign against him. The Jewish element now controls key positions in the American armed forces after having in the last weeks filled the posts of Secretary of War, Assistant Secretary of War, and Secretary of the Navy with subservient individuals, and attached a leading and very influential Jew, Colonel Julius Ox Adler, as Secretary to the Secretary of War. The forces opposing the Jewish element and the present policy of the United States have been mentioned in my reports, taking account also of the importance of the General Staff. The greatly gifted Lindbergh, whose connections reach very far, is much the most important of them all. The Jewish element and Roosevelt fear the spiritual and particularly the moral superiority and purity of this man. On Sunday, August 4th, Lindbergh delivered a blow that will hurt the Jews. He stressed that America should strive for sincere collaboration with Germany, with a view to peace and the preservation of Western culture. Several hours later, the aged General Pershing, who has long been a puppet in the hands of Roosevelt, which means of the Jews, read over the radio a declaration foisted upon him by the wire pullers to the effect that America would be imperiled by England's defeat. The chorus of the Jewish element casting suspicion on Lindbergh in the press, and his denunciation by a Senator Lucas, who spoke against Lindbergh over the radio Monday night at Roosevelt's behest as a fifth columnist, that is, a traitor, merely served to underline the fear of the spiritual power of this man, about whose progress I have reported since the beginning of the war, and in whose great importance for future German-American relations